Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. A very, very special edition. We have retired FBI agent Mike Campy, who was a tip of the spear, if you will, for the federal government's assault on the Genovese crime family in the 90s and 2000s. Just recently published a book called Mafia Takedown, which, you know, in my opinion, probably the best book on organized crime that's been written in at least the last decade. It's outstanding. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for the promotion.
The people like us that are, you know, that consume this kind of stuff had been kind of waiting for this book. It got delayed a couple times. And
yeah.
And then let me just tell you that it and I'm not just saying this because you're here. I mean, it met all the expectations and then some. And that's not even counting kind of the more salacious stuff with Cookie and the FBI agent. I mean, I know that's something that to draw some people in, but I think my audience and myself are more interested in like the inside baseball that we were able to glean from your book about all these guys that we talk about today: Patty Falsetti, Barney Bellomo, Ernie Muscarella, Georgie Barone. I mean, we've talked about him before. I mean, not today. Mickey Ragusa, all these Bronx guys. So, Mike, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you.
I kind of want to just address something right off the bat before we get into the book. And I know it's something that's kind of great debate. And I know that you've addressed it on another podcast or two. You never gave a definitive answer. I'm not asking you to give a definitive answer, but just your opinion. Is Barney Bellomo the boss of the Genovese crime family today?
Do I believe he is a power in the family? Absolutely. Do I believe, and when I think about things historically, like a Jerry Catena. Mm-hmm. Jerry Catena was an individual who George Barone identified as an official boss of the Genovese family who followed Vito Genovese. And Jerry Capisi stepped down at a stage in his life, retired, semi-retired, moved to Florida. In that capacity, I find Jerry to be, as George described, one of the brightest guys historically in the mob, and had money, big money. According to George, he thought he owned a piece of Wurlitzer, and a lot of his money was made by putting these machines into, diners, whether they were gambling machines or whether they were the music Wurlitzer machines. He was a bright businessman. So stepping away, I think, is a brilliant, bright move, because they're only going to contact you when they've got some advice they're seeking. Mm-hmm. So would Barney do that? My understanding is Barney spends a lot of time in Florida. Mm-hmm. But his crew, like an Ernie Muscarella, somebody that's sort of very discreet, even though D'Urso was making numerous recordings with Patty Falsetti, Tommy Cafaro, and everybody loved him. He never officially met with Ernie Muscarella. There was instances mm-hmm. where he was going to. So do I believe one of them can be the person, official boss? If I was to look at things, I'd be looking at them to find out who and how things are being run. But I do believe the power is in the Bronx.
Well, just, you know, this is neither here nor there, but, you know, us at Gangster, Original Gangsters Podcast, and I have a web magazine called Gangster Report. The way that we break it down right now is that Barney's still number one. Ernie is underboss, but is a level of underboss that exceeds any other crime family's underbosses. He has a level of autonomy and shot calling power that's kind of beyond a number two. Patsy Perello is consigliere. And Mickey Ragusa is being groomed to be underboss. So he's kind of acting underboss. And that Patty Falsetti is acting consigliere for Patsy Perello. And then you got guys like Ralphie Balsamo, who just walked out of prison in the last couple of days. Hippie Zanfordino, that are being groomed to be the next bosses. So that's kind of where my research has brought me.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a network of them up in the Bronx, and how they conduct business every day. You're going to have discussions. So is law enforcement focused on them? Because if you're focused on them, you are going to be able to indict and convict in a pretty quick turnaround based on that network of people. How to get into that is another story. There's strategies. And, you know, in my book, I talk about the hypocrisy. So I do know that certain people don't like certain people in that group. Like, I know Dominic Sicali is not a big fan of hippies.
Right.
And so Dominic was with Ernie back in the day.
Yeah.
So you got guys that have been through the system that, you know, whether they want to cooperate or don't want to cooperate, there's a way to facilitate evidence.
So let me, again, I apologize that we're jumping right off, you know, into the deep end with some stuff that not necessarily covered in your book, but I kind of wanted to get it out there just because you're the expert of all experts on the crime family. So I just wanted to be able to, you know, use you as a sounding board, and then we'll jump into the book. But last thing I'll ask on this front. So I don't know how close you're following the modern day legal machinations, but it looks like, based on court filings and other things, that there's some questions about Barney and his stepdaughter and his wife and his stepdaughter's father, Joey Lubrano, who's a Lucchese skipper, and the daughter, or the stepdaughter, I should say, Barney's stepdaughter that was living with him, got jammed up in a drug case. She got a light sentence. There are some gaps in the court filings that might make you think that maybe there's some stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know. Have you heard this? Do you have any opinion on it?
I don't.
Have you heard that Barney's stepdaughter got jammed up in a coke case?
Briefly, and I haven't been following that. So, okay. You know,
all right,
I do think if people are looking at things, that you'll find some clarity with whatever's going on if you're really drilling down. So I have not been looking at it. I haven't been that interested. I've become a grandfather, so yeah. I sort of enjoy that phase right now.
I just think the last thing I'll say about it, I think there are some people that feel like there's another shoe to drop possibly in that case. And I've been told that there's been at least one or two sit downs between the Lucchese's and the Genovese, kind of like who knew what, when, how was this young girl moving the weight that she was moving? Did her father know? Did her stepfather know? Did her mother know? There was a sentencing a couple months ago. Barney did not attend it, but Joey Lubrano did. And now she's in prison right now. So,
well, historically there is a relationship between the Genovese and Lucchese family. So, I mean, I could see discussions occurring that address this type of situation through those type of associations.
All right, so let's just jump. Let's jump. You know, we just jumped into the deep end of something else. Let's jump into the deep end of Mafia Takedown. A lot of it, you know, the story is surrounding a big bust of the crime family in the early 2000s, and that bust made it so the Chin, Vincent Gigante, who was the, you know, for my dollar, the most powerful Mafia Don of the last quarter of the 20th century, all due respect to Joe Mussino and John Gotti, but the Chin was in a kind of a stratosphere all his own, and he was already locked up, but it was looking like he was going to get out. And this case made it so he never saw the light of day and died in prison. And a lot of it was stemming from an organized crime figure in New York named Cookie Durso, who was a lightning rod, kind of a guy people either loved or hated, and wired up for a while. There was a situation at a Brooklyn social club with a murder of his cousin, and retribution and wanting to have retribution, and some guys were being protected, and he how long was he wired up for?
Almost 3 years, just around 3 years. So, and we just took him off the street because of his going to be utilized in murder, and there was a war going on at that time, or about to start, between the Albanian groups and right. the traditional Italian organized crime from New York.
So can you just talk about, like, how you got introduced to Cookie, how you, you know, how he came to you guys, and then how you ignited the operation?
So I'm going to briefly talk about it. I had a wire in a social club on Mulberry Street where I charged the acting administration and the consigliere of the Genovese family back in the day, 1996, 97. Jimmy Ida was a consigliere. He's doing life in prison. Durso used to frequent the social club that I had a bug in. And there's details in the book about how Durso caught the FBI going to install the bug at that social club. And, you know, after they were renovating the club and we removed our wire. So that said, I convicted the acting administration, which included Barney Belomo. Mickey Domino was the acting underboss. And a year or so later, I'd gotten information from a source, reliable source I had, of a threat to Sammy Meatball's life, Sammy Meatball's Aparo.
Salvatore Aparo, a.k.a. Sammy Meatballs, who was a mentor of Cookie Durso.
Absolutely. And I, short walk from my office to Little Italy, I went over there to see Sammy to provide information to him about my information of a threat to his life, just to give him a heads up. And if he wanted to reach out to me, you know, I gave him my number. And Sammy appreciated it. And later that day, Durso had come down to Little Italy, and he saw Sammy wasn't, you know, he felt awkward. He asked Sammy, what's wrong? That's when Sammy told him that Mike Campy, FBI, was here. And Durso's initial reaction was, he's with us, like, I'm corrupt. He said, no. Campy was the one that put Barney, Jimmy, Mickey to prison. It was at that time that Durso was considering cooperating. And when he heard my name, as far as being affiliated with convicting Barney, Ida, and them, if he was to cooperate, it would be, how does he meet me? How does he facilitate coordinating a cooperation? And it was at that time Durso was, you know, his life was in jeopardy. And not because of conduct, his conduct. It was the acting boss, this individual, Frank Farby Serpico,
yeah,
who wanted to kill Durso because he felt Durso disrespected him. During the same period, Durso's walking through Little Italy and runs into a former prosecutor who prosecuted him. She was with the Queens District Attorney's Office, but now she was a defense attorney. And that's when he asked her if she could facilitate a meeting with an FBI agent named Campy. And so that process evolved to an eventual meeting. And I go through it in the book, but I sat with Durso in the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Eastern District of New York, and I was corroborating in a debriefing session his information, criminal information, with a proffer to cooperate. And at that meeting, Durso said, I want to work with Campy. I'll work with Campy. So that's where it began. We thought we were only going to go 6 months from June of 1998 to December to address a group of guys that were robbing banks and the murder of Tino Lombardi, Durso's cousin, and Durso being shot in the head. And we just thought this window of time would be sufficient. And it turned out, as we made recordings, numerous types of crime schemes, multiple families, organized crime families, it evolved into like a 3-year process. And after 3 years, it was where Thurso was to kill George Barone, who was a longtime Genovese soldier that goes back to Vito Genovese days. George,
they called him Georgie the Jet because he started from the West Side Story, the Sharks and the Jets. Georgie Barone was like the boss of the Jets. So like he's like iconic in, you know, pop culture without people even realizing who he is or was.
Yeah. Yeah. He unique guy. He grew up in the Chelsea section of Manhattan, the West Side. And a lot of his mentors initially were Irish gangsters. And
he ran the docks. I mean, the Irish, you know, that was a big part of the waterfront. A
lot of gangs over there.
Yeah.
And a lot of crime, a lot of shooting. So.
Well, let me just throw, I just want to take us back real quick. We'll get back to Georgie Barone in a second, because I think the story of him and his cooperation and how it stemmed from this is utterly riveting. But let's just let people know that maybe that don't know. We've referenced it twice already, but let's just let people know about the Thurso. I think it was in 1994, had an issue with debts. Someone owed him money. I think it was Carmelo Polito, a.k.a. Carmine Pizza, who is a guy that is very powerful and allegedly very dangerous, but somebody that, and maybe I'm answering my own question. He's somebody that has been able to overcome a lot of things that normal wise guys aren't able to overcome in terms of just getting in debt to a lot of people around town. And
he was a degenerate gambler,
right?
And he had family, you know, that was constantly providing him some money to pay off the debts from gambling. And he had owed Thurso and Thurso's cousin, Tino Lombardi, money from loan shark debts. And Carmine Polito would frequent the social club in Little Italy where I had the bug. And mm-hmm. he would be seen on Monday nights when Monday night football was going on and they had actual gambling going on till 4 a.m. at the social club in the company of Ali Shades Malangone, who was a powerful Genovese capo, Baby Carmine Russo, Ilio Albanese, and others from the crew. And so the appearance was that he was an associate of Ali Shades Malangone crew, but actually Thurso and Tino were affiliated with Ross Ganji's crew.
Right. Rosario
and they were associates Ganji. In that. And since Polito borrowed money from both Lombardi and Thurso, he was affiliated with them. And they did not want to release him.
Tell me if I'm wrong on this. The hit that went out on Thurso and his cousin wasn't sanctioned. This was, from what I understand, this was Polito kind of acting on his own. And subsequently, the trend kind of continued where Carmine Polito, and again, he's still active right now. He's in prison, I think, serving a couple of years, has been able to get away with things that most people aren't able to get away with. He has kind of rabbis, Barney Belomo being one of them, that give him free passes. And I've heard that, you know, he's a guy that for whatever reason is kind of allowed to do things that other people aren't allowed to do because of stuff that he's done for people.
Well, the situation with Polito on whether it was sanctioned or wasn't sanctioned, I mean, we were making recordings about that. Initially, when Thurso was cooperating, we were believing that it was an unsanctioned murder and that Thurso was told, since he survived this attempt on his life, that he couldn't participate in retaliation in the murder of Polito, because there were five other people there when Durso was shot and Tino was killed. And there was a lot of cooperation going on at that time with all five families in the New York area, not to mention Philadelphia family. And so they were just placing it on hold, supposedly. But there came a point in time in this three-year period when we're making recordings with Sammy Aparo where they believed that it may have been sanctioned. And when I look back on the details, Durso and his cousins had an incident in the China Club, which was a popular Manhattan nightclub. And this supposedly was affiliated with Barney Belomo's, where they gave a beating to the bouncer. So that could have been one thing that was not in Durso's favor, since it was affiliated with Barney. Ali Shades had a very tight relationship with Barney Belomo due to his involvement and control of the garbage industry in the city for the Genovese family, which Barney was actively involved in as the acting boss. So Ali Shades would have more favor than a Ross Ganji as a capo, because Ross was sort of a brokester who'd borrow money from guys under him, like Durso. And so in that regard, I can see if they look to sanction this murder. I was on a surveillance when I was doing the Jimmy Ida Barney Belomo case, and I had Ali Shades, Ross Ganji, Mickey Domino, Jimmy Ida, and Barney Belomo all meeting uptown at a hotel just about 6 days before Durso's, or 6 days after Durso's shooting. Now, that could have been to address the retaliation, or it could have been sort of coordinating how it was screwed up and the murder should have occurred and didn't because the gun was too close to his head. When you look at the participants in Durso's shooting, you had not only Polito, but you had two of his cousins. One cooperated with us. And so that whole process of 3 years that followed when Durso was recording conversations gave a sense that maybe it was sanctioned. And if so, why? Polito went to prison on bank robbery, okay? And Barney was in prison. Polito speaks Italian. Barney speaks Italian. They could have... Barney could have recognized the relationship and it developed while they were in prison. And when he got released, and we made recordings about this, they wanted to release Polito to the Lucchese family. And Sammy Aparo, Joe Zito, another powerful member of the Genovese family, and Ross Ganji prevented that because we were making recordings of Durso wanting to retaliate when they gave him approval and authorization. So they don't want to release him to another family to be inducted. So there were a lot of conversations we made that I, you know, show the hypocrisy of the life, the treachery of the life. It's who's in favor as opposed to what the rules are. And it was a fascinating 3 years working him.
Let me ask you this. So it looks like, it doesn't look like, there was a gap of a couple years between the shooting and when Durso started to cooperate. And it seemed from reading your book that at least a nice chunk of the impetus for Durso to cooperate was for the let's say those 3 years, he's looking for some retribution. He's saying, these guys tried to kill me, they killed my cousin, and you're tying my hands. You're not letting me do anything for restitution in that world. Is that true?
Yeah, and when you looked at it, so when Durso was shot was 94. When I convicted Barney Belomo was at trial in 97.
Yeah.
When Durso cooperated was in 98. So yeah. Polito and Belomo were in prison back in 97, 98.
Yeah.
And so at that time, after Durso got shot, he was doing well in numerous schemes as a you know, operating bettors that were loose, making money from gambling, making money as a loan shark. He put money into buildings where he was renting. He owned buildings in an area of the Greenpoint, Williamsburg, and that area was jumping in price in real estate because you had a view from there, was one stop away from Manhattan, and you had the view of the skyline. So he was a wise, shrewd business guy, and he was being used by Sammy Meatballs and the crew as far as an earner. And he was a tough kid that didn't take, you know, anything from anybody. And even though he was prohibited from retaliating against Pulido, he did facilitate Pulido being shot in the head at his pizzeria with an association, which I cite in the book, of a guy that said he'd never go back to jail and don't worry about it. And when Pulido got shot in the head, word came back from Barney that if they attach this shooting to Durso, he's a dead man. So we made recordings about that.
Let me throw one more name out. I neglected to mention him when I was running down my my current roster of the shot callers and Genovese, and I'd be remiss if I didn't throw his name out there because I'm told that he's the current street boss, Danny Pagano. Did you get a opportunity to work Danny at all?
We made some recordings about Danny. And I think it was that there was something going on in the court system regarding Danny Pagano, but he was a well-respected Genovese low-key guy. I do think at that time, 98 through 2001, he was being investigated, may have even been charged with some type of crime, but he's an historic figure with the Genovese family.
There was something in your book, and I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but I'm just like a kid in a candy store having your ear like this. But there's a real low-key guy right now named Jimmy Tenaglia, James Tenaglia, Jimmy T, who, according to your book, and I think some of these wires showed, that Danny Pagano was trying to block his initiation. Eventually, he got made. Tony D, I believe, and some other guys were able to step in and help him get his button. But it's interesting now because I'm told that Pagano and Jimmy Tenaglia now are really close. So do you remember that situation where?
Yeah, I do know. So Jimmy T was the same neighborhood as Durso, and they would talk on occasion. We recorded conversations with him. We knew Jimmy T was around the West Side, and the West Side was the power. That was Chin's crew. So you had Quiet Dom, I think, was one mm-hmm. of the people there supporting Jimmy T. And I think, you know, I don't know that Durso had a lot of respect for Jimmy T, the recordings we made, but you had Anthony Palumbo, Tony D, and you had Danny Pagano. And there was an issue where they didn't like each other because they didn't, you know, they wanted to go to trial. It was sort of similar to Jimmy Ida with Barney Belomo. Jimmy wanted Barney to come to trial, not take a guilty plea on my prior indictment. I think it was a similar thing that was going on with Pagano and Tony D. And
yeah, I've heard that. Know, and then, which is also interesting that, almost 30 years later, Danny Pagano is very, I'm told, is very close with Jimmy T and is very close with Tony D. So it's like, I guess that's like that. And it's probably like that in any world, whether it be friendships outside of work or work relationships. At certain points in time, you can be at odds, and at other times, you can be best friends. That's just, that's human nature.
But is it genuine that they put things in the past, or is it just presenting a certain false sense? Because I do know from the recordings how Patty Falsetti hated Butch Manovecki, hated him, the tone of his voice in the recording. And Butch was somebody, you know, made guy in the Brooklyn crew, who I thought was a particularly evil guy. I mean, we've had recordings about him and with him where he really was. I don't want to get into it because it's more family related, but I can see Patty disliking him, and respect Patty for that.
Yeah, so let's use that as a segue. So Cookie Durso at some point gets introduced to Patty, and becomes a Patty Falsetti, one of Patty Falsetti's right hand men, and this is when you're working him, and Falsetti is a guy that even back then had a lot of respect from the administrators, and they had Falsetti overlooking some of the activities on the waterfront and in Florida and in New Jersey and New York. Let's bring George Barone back into the picture here. And you were able to kind of tell me if I'm wrong again, you were able to get a lot of insight and perspective on what was going on there from Durso. And then Barone ends up cooperating because they want to kill Barone.
Yeah. So Joe Zito was a historic figure that was indicted in the Windows investigation. And Joe Zito was acquitted after trial. They offered Joe the position of capo. Joe, being a bright guy, didn't want it. He thought that there'd be a focus from the FBI and law enforcement on him since he got acquitted. He recommended Ross Ganji. But it was Joe Zito who introduced Patty Falsetti to Mike Durso at a Christmas party in Florida. And they hit it off. And Joe Zito, you know, described how in a recording with Durso, he put Durso with the power, the Bronx power. So I believe that Joe recognized that Chin's West Side crew was going to probably lose power over the years, and that the Bronx with Barney Bellomo and others, Patty Falsetti, would gain this power and become the new power for the Genovese family. And he said, I placed you with the power. Well, Falsetti, historically, again, was a tough kid, and him and Durso would hit it off based on their similar personalities. George Barone, who's an old-time gangster, soldier, was eventually released from Vito Genovese to Fat Tony Salerno's crew. And Barone, being the individual involved with the waterfront for the Genovese family, provided Falsetti, Tommy Cafaro with jobs on the waterfront. And they earned a significant amount of money there.
I think in your book, it says that in 1999 or 2000, they were making 300K or something.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at
that money 25 years ago.
Chin's kids, relatives, I think there was 13 or 14 making $400,000+.
Right.
Being paid 24 hours a day. Actually, I think 3 hours in overtime, 27 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they didn't have to leave their house. So that type of opportunity was huge. And when George Barone was going to prison, I believe it was in the 70s, maybe it was the 80s. Chin asked George, because they were close, they were both around Vito Genovese at the time, asked if he would introduce Andrew Gigante to this associate of George's who was making money at the ports repairing containers. His name was Umberto Guido.
Yeah.
And George did it as a favor to Chin before going to prison. And when he came out of prison, Burke Guido owed him about $60,000 on some type of restaurant transaction, something that was quasi-legitimate. And at that same time, they were wanting George to help facilitate Burke Guido and Andrew Gigante getting work down in Florida, where George was. And George had a very strong relationship with Cubans down there. And all George wanted was what was owed to him.
Was what owed to him.
And that whole thing, they found disrespectful for Barone to ask Andrew Gigante, Andrew being the son of Chin, for money owed to him. They never shared it with Chin. And really, that facilitated a conspiracy to murder George Barone by people, Patty Falsetti and Cafaro, for Andrew Gigante. And it was really so hypocritical. I mean, when I put sports analogy, my thought is I would have given the money out of my own pocket to George for what he's done for me to in my ability to make a living at the ports with minimal work, you know, Patty or Tommy or Andrew.
What wasn't there a, from again, my research and reading your book and reading through court filings and whatnot, there was a physical altercation or almost a physical altercation between Barone and Andrew Gigante, right? That kind of led to
Barone.
They were arguing
take...
about this situation and had to get separated or
well, that's George. George is a very stubborn-headed type of guy that I mean, he was practically 80 when he cooperated with me.
Right.
And he was the type of guy that in proffers with the defense attorney, not proffers, but in these hearings with defense attorney, it was like he wanted to go outside to have a fist fight.
Right.
And it's just George being George. I joked with him, you know, when we were doing the proffer, he said to me at one point in the initial discussion, he didn't know he was Italian until he was 8 years old because the father abandoned the family. Well, after that, he was, again, his mentors were a lot of Irish guy gangsters. So I joked with him because my mother's from Ireland that I didn't think he was Italian. I think he's just a stubborn Mick. He laughed out loud and just that stubbornness, he doesn't back down from people. And he wanted what was in his eyes owed to him legitimately by Burke Guido.
And you'd think that, I mean, that anecdote, 100% true. But isn't it also, like you said, like all the years that Barone worked diligently keeping the waterfront, you know, in the pocket of the Genovese, controlling things, taking care of, you know, doing a lot of dirty work, getting his hands, you know, really dirty. And it just seemed like if you're George Barone, besides the micro of not being able to collect money that's due to you, you just think there would be more overall respect for what you had done. And I know that there was wiretaps with Falsetti getting Uncle Patty Falsetti being caught complaining about having to deal with Barone.
Yeah. Because George was a blunt guy. And so for Falsetti trying to walk between the raindrops between Andrew, who was the son of Chin Gigante,
right,
and George, who provided Patty with this livelihood and probably the justification foundation for him to be inducted into the Genovese family, and yet on the recordings, you can see that Patty Falsetti had respect and cared about George, but at the same time, he was thinking, just step away from the money. They wanted George to step away from the money that was owed to him, where George facilitated Burke Guido to become a multimillionaire. And it was a modest amount of money that George wanted that was owed to him. And they just wanted to step away. I could see Chin being livid. The whole case came down. Chin didn't realize, why don't they just give George the money?
Yeah.
My understanding from a source was that Chin was pissed off. They didn't pay George what he was owed. And it caused this whole turmoil. When you look historically, George was around when Albert Anastasia and the Gambino family or the Anastasia family back in the day, they controlled the ports in Brooklyn and Staten Island, while Vito Genovese controlled the ports in Manhattan and Jersey. So there was sort of probably almost a 50-50. But when that transitioned to the containerization process, where you didn't manually load ships, you loaded containers and used cranes to put these on the ship, the land in New Jersey provided much more of an opportunity for that containerization repair business and the containerization, where the Genovese had like 90% of the union controlled by them. And that's where they controlled the ILA and the money opportunities. George facilitated that.
Well, you know, Patty, those wiretaps, it was a lot of like Patty was tasked with running point for that whole situation. And that situation got so crazy and chaotic that Patty was complaining, like, every 30 seconds I'm getting a phone call and having to deal with this and having to deal with that. And I guess Georgie was making quasi threats or real threats, saying, "Hey, I got a bunch of Cubans behind me and I'll go to war with you."
Like, yes.
I'll take my Cubans and I'll go to war with my own crime family. And it was obviously a stressful situation and led to not just, like we're saying, Cookie Dursa was wired up and helped make this case, but then George Barone eventually cooperates and gets on the stand as well.
Yeah. George was, in George's debriefings, he would describe how the role he played in conducting murders for the Genovese family. He'd negotiate contracts for the ILA, fly out meeting with shipping executives, and then catch a flight to Miami to conduct the murder for Fattoni Salerno. It was a fascinating type of guy because he was a bright guy. I can see him being hard in negotiating for pro-union contracts with shipping executives, at the same time making huge money for the Genovese family and just being loyal when it came to conducting murders for Fattoni Salerno, who he liked. He appreciated it. But it was confusing to him, I'm sure, to not be provided with funds upon his release from prison. And it was like, I remember him describing, "Mike, I didn't know how to cross the street when I got out of prison." It was just from being in prison so long, and there was a disconnect. So,
but let's talk a little bit about something that I found really fat. Your whole book is fascinating, but this little slice of it I found extra fascinating was that, and I actually wrote about it, and I don't know if you knew, but I've written some articles that have cited and kind of acted as promotion for the book. One of the things was that Cookie Dursa was having trouble getting his button for various reasons. And he had offers from, according to your book, had offers from Buffalo and Joe Todaro Jr., Joe Pizza. And had offers from Al Bruno, who was the faction boss for the Western Massachusetts Genovese crime family wing.
Springfield,
so I guess Cookie really and Al Bruno got along really well. So you had like this, he was almost like a highly thought of free agent that one group was hesitant to possibly bring in for whatever reasons. But then you had other groups that were kind of, nipping at his feet to try to bring him into their group because they could use him.
Yeah, no, Adolfo Bruno, I sort of think he was comfortable with Dursa. He liked Dursa. He liked Sammy Meatballs. Sammy Meatballs, historic guy that went back talking about his role in the French Connection, heroin case. And so Sammy was the one that said no to Adolfo Bruno. Let's keep it on. Keep him here with us. But Adolfo talked about providing Chin with weapons for murders. I think that when you see the discovery of what Dursa's recordings captured, I think that may have facilitated his murder. And
finish.
Go ahead.
No, you finish, please.
Well, I could see because you had Larry Dentico, who was also with George Barone and the Jets and all, those people looking at those reports and coordinating a murder without the kid and the guys up there who participated in it knowing the details, the historic details. I sort of think that may have evolved because it would be secretive. And, they're going to participate in the murders because they're asked to do it by other powers in the Genovese family. And that family was facilitated. That area was Genovese.
What's also pretty fascinating, I keep on using that word because your book is utterly fascinating. And again, I know, myself and my audience, we love the granulars and finding those little layers and nooks and crannies that maybe get lost in the bigger story. But when you're talking about Adolfo Bruno and the political machinations that led to his demise years later, he was very close to Farby. Now, Farby's trying to block Durso. Bruno is very close to Farby, and Bruno's going, I don't know if Farby knew or not, but Bruno's going to Durso saying, like, don't worry about those guys. You can come into my camp. And then when Farby Serpico is out of the picture is when Bruno has his problems. And from, again, my research and talking to people, the guys that came after Farby, Little Artie Nigro and Scott DeLuca, were guys that Al Bruno did not pay the proper, again, this is based on what I've been told, did not pay the proper respect to in the years leading up to them taking power, kind of dismissing them, not realizing that these might be guys that I got to do business with. And then Farby's out of the picture. Little Artie's now the guy there, and he doesn't like Bruno because he feels that Bruno's been dismissing him for the previous decade. So he's more prone to be open to getting rid of Bruno when the situation, you know, presented itself. So it's just kind of interesting how those relationships.
There's a lot of baggage carried, based on your perception of how you're mistreated. There could be a lot of teasing. Yeah. Or you just think you're more powerful. And at the end of the day, you know, years later, that could facilitate, yeah, I'll do it. I'll kill him.
Well, sometimes also, you know, the water boy at the end of the bench 10 years later can be the star player or be the head coach. So you be careful how you treat the water boy, you know?
Yeah.
What about Todaro? Did you in that interaction? Did your investigations into the Genovese at any time dovetail with the Buffalo guys coming in and doing business?
He offered to bring a mic up because Todaro, Sammy Meatballs, Joe Zito, Joe Todaro in like the winter would frequent a restaurant in Lauderdale, Johnny Meatballs restaurant. And I believe Johnny Meatballs had a relationship to Todaro, like a nephew or something like that. Okay. And that Durso helped resolve a dispute that Johnny Meatballs was having with a local guy, and Todaro appreciated that. But Durso, you know, if he was going to go with anyone, it would have been with Patty Falsetti's crew because of the bond that he had developed with Falsetti and realizing that, you know, Falsetti being related relationship with Ernie Muscarella and Barney Belomo, that was the power base, even though Barney was still in prison. The Todaro thing, they weren't going to release. And I think Todaro's in a better place for that because, I mean, we could have gone up there briefly, made some recordings about what was going on there and just had Durso return to New York. I mean, that was the thing about Durso. Durso was a very wise, streetwise, sophisticated type of schemes that we coordinated, you know, from the FBI standpoint, that would provide an appearance of earning money. And we could have bounced him all over the country. I mean, he was the type of guy that they were looking to use as one of five people from the Genovese family. Each organized crime family in New York was going to war at the end of our case against the Albanian gangsters. And to be one of the five people that the Genovese family was going to pick showed the respect that they had for Durso to be utilized in this capacity. And my understanding was they were going to have fully automatic weapons. And so, I mean, I don't know that Durso's familiar with a fully automatic weapon, but to have him in that capacity to do this type of go to war against the Albanians, that was, you know, a sign of respect and, you know, a future for him.
So, you know, if you don't mind, I didn't really want to lead with the Durso Joy Adam thing, but I think we should probably address it. Because that was something I think that the general public is riveted by, but I mean, whatever, but I still want to talk about it. So for people that might not know, Cookie Durso claims that
it wasn't named. Yeah. That I had to send the book down. Jerry Capisi wrote about it.
Yeah. So Mike didn't put her name in, but we know her name to be Joy Adam. And we can cut this out if you don't want it in there. But yeah.
I would just identify, and I subsequently learned before he told Capisi, he told another person who was a journalist, you know, for the New York Post. And that information was years before Capisi even knew. It was wild to me, you know, hearing this stuff from Durso years later and corroborating it with the various people that had the information, including handwritten notes of what he was describing.
And she was cleared.
I don't know what happened there. Yeah, I was retired. But as soon as I got the information, I tried to escalate it, and I don't know what happened there.
Well, she also
seems as though she was cleared.
Right. And there was also another situation that she got into more recently where she was again investigated and then cleared of trying to manipulate the computer system in relation to an investigation into Philadelphia. The New York guys were, the New York office was investigating Joey Merlino, who's the former boss of the Philadelphia Mafia. Office didn't want the Philadelphia office knowing what they knew. So they were going into the computer system and blocking Philadelphia's access to it. Eventually came to be in the 2016 East Coast LCN case that jammed up Merlino. But I know she was involved in that or allegedly involved in that and was cleared of it. But can you kind of just talk maybe without, again, we don't have to mention her name again, but so Durso claims that a female FBI agent seduced him. Is that the best way to
say
it?
That was what his, you know, he spoke to with federal investigators about it. And it was only, I think we were just 2 weeks into his cooperation, the way he described it to me, where he got a call and was summoned to a location where he thought he was going to be meeting with us. And it was just her.
Right.
And and at that meeting, you know,
sometimes
the suggestion was, excuse me.
Sometimes
you can't make it up because what he's saying,
truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, when I read articles now about school teachers doing stuff with minors, I just don't understand, you know, aren't there enough men out there in the world? Yeah. You don't have to go making such bizarre efforts with minors or guys who pled guilty 2 weeks earlier to a murder. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Well, it just doesn't make sense.
That's all we really need to do on it. We don't need to get that deep into it. Just
my head explodes thinking about it. It really does. Reliving it.
It affected your book getting out, and it must have been a real pain in the ass. I understand.
It was. And is.
Can you just, as we're wrapping up here, just do you think it's accurate? And I'm guessing you do, but tell me if you don't. That when people talk about the Genovese crime family, they say this is the Ivy League of organized crime. This is at a whole other level than the way other groups operate in terms of their ability to function, their ability to shield, knowledge, their ability to make money. Would you say that organization is kind of in a space all by its own, and that they're the gold standard?
I do think that they had a sophistication of insulating power, but this is supposed to be a secret organization for all five families. And when you look at when Italians came to the country, you know, the late 1800s, early 1920s, there was so much going on where you wouldn't recognize it as an organization initially, other than you had bootlegging, you had World War I, World War II. It wasn't really until, I mean, Lucky Luciano was operating brothels, but they never thought of it being on a national level with all these different families all located all over the country. That 1957 Appalachian meeting was the one that really identified, magnified what was going on there. And a lot of these individuals that were all over the country meeting in such a remote area of upstate New York was, you know, a clear indication that there's something more complex. The Genovese family, historically, when you look back at Lucky Luciano organizing it, you had Vito Genovese and Frank Costello, you know, at the top when Lucky was in prison. I do go into the hypocrisy when I cite these various murders in each family going each decade where the treachery exists. But yes, the Genovese family being involved in unions, money-making opportunities, deceiving the other LCN families, they are sophisticated in that manner. But every day they're discussing criminal conduct. That's the nature of the business. It's law enforcement's efforts to identify the types of crimes. When you look at the unions that are controlled by organized crime, I think I have 100 locals, and I compare this to like a NFL team. Your center gets injured. You don't play 11 against 10. Right. You replace him with somebody who's not as good. They're not going to step away from these locals, you know, unless it becomes devastating to them from the standpoint of whatever money you earn criminally, that the government forfeits it and takes it. That may be something that discourages them from getting involved on the capacity of an organized crime family earning this type of money over the years. But yes, they, you know, I've made recordings and I cite in the book how they deceived the other families. You know, they don't, the Genovese members didn't even know that Frank Farby Serpico was their acting right. boss. They concealed right. that from their own family. There was only a select few that realized that. And
the public didn't know about Giganti until the last, let's say, 10 years of his reign. For the first 10 years of his reign, everybody thought he was a behind-the-scenes guy. I mean, he was a behind-the-scenes guy.
But I mean, Benny Squint Lombardo was somebody right. that was concealed as not. Jerry Katina wasn't yeah. identified as a maid. They knew that these guys played roles on some high level, but they didn't know officially who was the boss. And so it probably continues today. When you ask me yeah. who's running it, I'd have to be involved to get specific there.
That's how
I do believe it's a Bronx crew.
So, okay. So let's end on this note. And I want to present something to you that I've heard, and it goes to the fact that this Genovese family has a reputation for being very mysterious and, you know, not everything that meets the eye and stealth. So we mentioned Ali Shades. You know, Ali is in his late 80s right now. I'm told he's still very, very sharp minded. He's got to walk with a walker and sometimes he's in a wheelchair. But at the very least, I'm told, the guy still holds juice in the crime family right now in terms of advising the guys that are running things, and that he has more juice than a non-administration guy would have, that he's kind of the guy behind the guy behind the guy. Is there any way that Ali Shades is actually the boss of the crime family right now?
I don't think Ali Shades is the boss. We made recordings with Alan Longo, who was the individual, the street boss, right, who was the conduit between the West Side and the families and other families. And Alan Longo was recorded talking about how Ali Shades, when they were making the movie Mickey Blue Eyes, I cited this in the book, and you had, what was that actor's name? I'm horrible with actors. Hugh Grant and Elizabeth Hurley, and Ali Shades at an Up East Side restaurant was identifying himself right. as a capo with the Genovese family and identifying the guys around as soldiers right. and associates of his and how they conduct business and what they control. And it was partly because he was infatuated with Elizabeth Hurley, but they, yeah, But I mean, in that regard, I can see why would you want to trust him in the capacity? Maybe you pick his brain regarding the karting industry, but you're not going to have a lot of you're not going to have a lot of respect from people underneath. Does he know about the karting industry? Yes.
Yeah. Ran a lot of the garbage. I've heard that Barney and Ernie think of him very highly and seek him for counsel. Again, that's neither here nor there. I just wanted to get your take on it. Anything else you want to share with people, let people know about the project?
Well, I hope they enjoy the book. I mean, if you're interested in seeing the real story, I do point out some hypocrisy in the life with various murders, including, you know, Crazy Joe Gallo, you know, Joe Bonanno writing a book of 60, you know, appearing on 60 Minutes, a bunch of different things that sort of demonstrate it's not so secret. Guys have egos, they have flaws, and it's partly to discourage guys from getting involved in the life. If you're sort of growing up like a juvenile delinquent and you think you sort of got a street sense, you could probably do something much more worthwhile. And that's part of it, if they read. But at the same time, another aspect of the book is to get law enforcement to work. I mean, my impression of why you get involved in an FBI agent is because of the interesting opportunities in conducting investigations. And yet at the same time, a lot of guys get complacent because you get paid the same to just sit on your ass and do nothing as you would getting out in the street, because it is extremely interesting work. I really liked arresting bad guys because I thought of, you know, I didn't know whose life I was saving or helping, but I knew when I'm taking some of these bad guys off the street that life is going to be much easier for others.
This is the, so, I said before it was the last question. I'm always saying it's going to be the last question. There's another question. This is the real last question. 2025, you've been out of the office for how long?
I went to corporate in 2007. So I left in 2007.
So almost 20 years. It's now 2025.
Yeah.
Looking at LCN today in America, knowing that Joey Merlino has his own podcast.
Yeah.
What does that say to you? What does that say to you about the state of the 2025 American Mafia, that a very prominent Don, not anymore because of this, but a very prominent Don jumped on YouTube, which is the equivalent of in the 1990s, if NBC gave him his own talk show. Like, what does that say
it's
about?
Bizarre to me. It is bizarre because yeah. I get people sending me videos to see about the accuracy of how they like bump heads. Like,
yeah,
I think somebody sent me a thing about Michael Francis talking about the FBI investigating organized crime as though they're treacherous. And it was sort of like, so you don't think they were treacherous? I sort of was like thinking of murderers, the top of my head, all of a sudden were bouncing out of who was killing, like Roy DeMeo, how he would butcher, dismember, Tommy Karate. So I was thinking, yep. So you didn't think there was treachery there? I'd rather than make money as a podcast trying to entertain. I do see, you know, the banging heads sometimes. You know, because who's a rat when they identify Dominic Sicali, yeah. And
they all do the mental gymnastics about why their ratting was not as bad as other people's ratting. And it's like a massaging the truth or the facts for what suits them, you know, for their,
but brand. I do believe that they're that's going to generate conversations in prison with the guys who are doing life. Jimmy Ide is still doing, you know, he's in prison for life. And I would imagine it probably ticks off the old timers when they look at what's going on now. But at the same time, maybe the next generation is going to realize there's other opportunities that they can sort of make a living without getting involved in the criminal life side of it. About the grandpa that was a gangster.
Yeah, this was this was one of my all-time favorite episodes I've done. Mike, you are an encyclopedia of knowledge. You present the way that you tell the stories are great. Your insight was just, phenomenal. You've done it all. You've said it all. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
And just tell everyone where they can get the book. Mafia Takedown by Mike Cannon.
On Amazon to buy the book. If you enjoyed reading the book, then go ahead and make a comment. I know the publisher appreciates, you know, the feedback that they're getting from readers. And, you know, I have buddies that I worked with, both NYPD, FBI. They want it to be like, you know, a series, a TV series or something.
Oh my God. This is right. This is tailor made for someone to come in and make it a TV series. This is the dream for every author. I hope someone comes.
I'm horrible with actors. I can't tell you actors, but I've got guys wondering if Brad Pitt's going to play them. And I'm like, No, I got Danny DeVito playing you or something like that. It's just comical.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Enjoy the rest of the day. This was an original gangsters highlight of the podcast. We've been doing the podcast now for 5 years. The last 2 years have we been on YouTube. And this is just, again, one of the highlights of me doing the OG pod. So, Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. You have a good one.
And we will see you next time. Please like, share, and subscribe. Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm Scott Bernstein for Mike Campy and Benny Augusta, my producer behind the glass. We're out. We'll see you next time.